This is a podcast from Shooting People. Hi, it's Andy Conway welcoming you to a very special Shooting Screenwriters show. As a curtain raiser to the 2008 Cheltenham Screenwriters Festival, here's an interview from last year's festival with Oscar-winning screenwriter Diana Ossana. She came to the 2007 festival after her enormous success with Brokeback Mountain and gave us all a sneak preview of her TV miniseries Comanche Moon, as well as taking half an hour out especially to talk to Shooting Screenwriters. Okay, I'm very, very pleased to announce that I'm here with Diana Ossana. We're at the Cheltenham Screenwriters Festival and you've had a very, very hectic afternoon because you're being whisked from one session to the next.
It's tiring, but it's nice. I mean, how can I complain? It's good attention. It's attention for writers, and I think that's always a positive thing.
Are you just here for this festival?
I'm here only for this festival, and I agreed to come because it's about writing. It's about screenwriters, and that's a rarity in the world. I think that writers simply are not acknowledged anymore like they used to be. Writing used to be something that was valued and considered important, and I think it's being much taken for granted now with the advent of what they call reality television, for example, in the U.S., which is not reality. Anytime you put a camera on a person, they're going to act differently. Absolutely. And on a lot of those shows, the people are coached anyway by the producers. You know, they want controversy, they want conflict, they want arguments, they want drama. And so they'll coach those people.
And prod them.
Yes.
In order to get
yes, and infuriate them and lie to them in order to get them worked up, that kind of thing. So there's, you know, but even on reality TV now, some of it's scripted. And we just had a huge controversy over there with the Writers Guild about those writers getting paid that were scripting these reality shows. They shouldn't be paid.
I would have thought they'd have paid them to keep that bit quiet. Should we start by talking about how you got into becoming a screenwriter?
Actually, the first writing project I was ever paid for was writing a screenplay. And it was a screenplay about Pretty Boy Floyd that I co-wrote with Larry McMurtry for Warner Brothers many, many years ago. It's kind of resurfaced, and it was actually a fun script to write, and I think it's a pretty good script. Hopefully it'll get made into a film someday.
So you actually got paid for it, but it's still never been made?
No, it hasn't been made, although we met with Jerry Weintraub, who's the producer on it, again about a year ago. We love Jerry. He's great. He's one of the last great sort of moguls, real producers. Is the real deal.
So were you a writer already before you tackled this script?
I wrote for my own personal self. I didn't write for a living, although I had worked in the legal field and did what I considered to be technical writing, essentially, you know, writing briefs and memorandum and pleadings and demand letters and that sort of thing. But no, not a writer making a living with writing.
So how did you come to be writing this script?
Well, Larry had a heart attack in the summer of 1991 and had open heart surgery in December of that year and sort of washed up on my doorstep through the process of healing from that surgery. And he healed physically great, but emotionally he had sort of a breakdown. And it happened right about the time he landed at my house. And he usually stayed for a couple of days and wound up staying at my house for a couple of years. And in the process of that, had stopped writing and even stopped reading and kept getting projects sent to him from various directors and studios and kept batting them away. And one day I said, you know, this is ridiculous. He needs to get back into the world of writing. And so I presented him with a bunch of interesting tidbits about Pretty Boy that were either factual or mythical. And he became interested and said he would write the script if I wrote it with him. And I said, well, you know, you need to convince Warner Brothers of that. So we went and did our pitch, and they said, have at it. And we launched off into the screenplay, and that's how it began.
And from then you went on to writing other projects together?
Yes, actually. After we finished that script, we immediately started writing a novel about Charles Arthur Floyd. Our imaginations were so packed with the information, we just couldn't stop. It was sort of like a horse going to the barn, it was at a gallop. And we finished the draft of that novel in less than 6 months.
I find it really interesting because I mean, I write alone, but I have occasionally written with a writing partner, and the experience is beautiful. I've always loved the fact that you kind of get instant feedback on your work. You don't have to do that thing of putting it in a drawer for 6 months before you can get a fresh eye on it.
The best thing about collaborating on scripts, and I think it's the norm actually, collaboration on scripts, is that you get instant feedback. If somebody doesn't like something you've done, they'll say so, you know, and even after a first draft, you go through it and read it again, you start talking about it and arguing or whatever is done. But I'll tell you, through that process, it just gets better. It really does.
So what's your day-to-day writing relationship as a partnership? How does it work?
Well, Larry and I are very different from one another in just the way we operate in the world. He's very much stuck to a routine, and he prefers it that way. He likes things to stay exactly the same. He doesn't like change. Me, on the other hand, I'm very sort of adaptive, and I'm more flexible. Larry gets up in the morning, takes a bath, gets dressed, takes a walk, and then he writes 5 pages. Whether it's a script or a novel, he has this limit, and this is how he does it. But the thing he does it every day, 7 days a week, until he has a first draft. If he's writing by himself, he does it that way. And writing with him, one of the things that I learned very quickly is that I have to write every day, because he does. He'll give me his 5 pages. He still types on a manual typewriter. I will take his 5 pages. This is how we'll make the start. This is the very beginning, page one. And I put them into my computer, okay? And usually I will try very hard the first 15 or 20 pages not to cut any of his work, and I will add on to that. I will add maybe another 5 pages. I might add 8 pages. And then he gives me his work at 9 a.m., and I may work on it the rest of the day, depending on how long it takes me to do that writing. I'll print it out from my computer, give it to him. He'll have that for the next morning start. And then he'll do his next 5 pages. But he will never do any more or any less than that. And he might stop in the middle of a sentence, which I will finish, by the way.
So he gets paid for it and
he's done. And it's so funny because we do that until we have a first draft. And then he will read the entire thing front to back, as will I, and then he'll start making notes. And generally, on the second draft, Larry just sort of says, you have at it, you do it. You do the second draft, and then I'll give you notes, or, you know, rework it. And as I'm doing that second draft, I may go to him and say, Larry, would you have a shot at this one single scene? It's the scene between blah, blah, and this is what I think it needs kind of thing. And he may do that. He'll write the scene, and then he'll give it to me, and I might use the whole thing, or I just might not use any of it. It just depends. So, and he writes more skeletal when he's writing with me. I fill in a tremendous amount on his writing, and sometimes he'll write so skeletal that I don't understand what the heck he's talking about, so I'll have to go say, what is this here? What do you mean? And he just kind of makes an assumption that I'll know. The funny thing about when I say finishing his sentences, and when all of the interview stuff started with Brokeback, we were doing sort of 8 hours a day of interviews sometimes. And the publicist came to me the middle of the day, the first day, and he said to me, you two are like twins. He said, you'll start a sentence and Larry will finish it, or he starts a sentence and you finish it. And we hadn't even noticed that we do that in talking.
Yeah.
But it was really funny because that's kind of the way that we write too.
I think it begins with the relationship, doesn't it? You have us people together rather than as writers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. As friends, exactly.
You went on to start developing some TV series.
Yes.
And you've done 2, I think. Is that right?
We've started, we just finished our first pilot for ABC, turned in our first draft, which I'm sure we'll get notes on. And we're about to finish another pilot for Fox, mm-hmm. on 2 TV series, and they're both contemporary.
Can you talk about the working process on those?
Sure. The first one is for ABC is about a small town, contemporary small town sheriff in the Midwest. And it's a town of maybe 3,000 people, and the trials and tribulations of his life and the people in the town, which, come to think of it, aren't really that different than in the big city. It has all sort of moved across the landscape in America. They have the same issues: immigration, drugs, you know, crime, petty crime, that kind of thing. Good kids going bad. All the things that happen in big cities too.
Was that the extract you just showed in the big session?
No, that was a mini series, actually, that we finished. That was an adaptation of the last of the Lonesome Dove novels, Comanche Moon.
It's funny what you say about they may be set in kind of the westerns in effect, but when you showed the clip, I didn't know that, and I immediately thought this is a contemporary piece. Just the interactions between this couple just seemed like so much like a modern couple.
Right, that's because in Larry's in my mind, we are first and foremost realistic writers. We write realistic fiction, and in our scripts we tend to be very realistic, and we want to write about characters and situations that anyone and everyone can relate to as human beings. The domestic situation in the one clip, for example, it's not a lot different than domestic situations today, except they don't have a dishwasher, they don't have running water, you know, they don't have electricity, that kind of thing. But the people themselves are still just trying to get through the days, raise their children the best they know how, bicker and argue with one another and try to get along and try to keep the husband at home who has to may have to travel for work. In that instance, he had to travel to help find a young killer. But still, they're the same kinds of issues and problems. It's just that the detritus that surrounds it is different.
You showed that scene as an example of a scene that you thought was crucial for forming the character, but executives wanted to cut out because there wasn't enough action. It was too talky.
Yeah, they thought it was too slow and too talky. But these are the scenes and the sequences that will engage an audience and connect the audience with the characters. And it's a common theme. I'm just thinking about this in Larry's novels too. Very often his novels start out sort of at a slow pace, and you can see that in almost every one of them. They start out slowly, and you sort of are pulled into these people's lives and into caring about the characters inadvertently through just the mundane and the humorous, so that when tragedy strikes, you're devastated. Otherwise, you don't care. And these are the things, these are the arguments that I would make to these executives. You know what? Unless we know these characters, unless we feel something about them, and we're like voyeurs, we're watching them in very personal situations, we won't care about them later when bad things happen.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, when the reality of life hits.
I'm really interested in writing for a TV series where you've got a lot of space to really kind of explore characters, as opposed to a feature film where you've got 2 hours to tell this story and it's got to be kind of very, very lean and cut down to the bone, and you can't really mess around for very long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, the mini-series that we have, the six-hour mini-series, it has its own obstacles too, writing in that sort of length. Because by the time you've gotten to part three, for example, you've kind of forgotten what happened in part one. But it all has to connect. You know, there's something to be said for each genre. You have the space and the time and the long story to tell a good story, but you also have to tell it in a way that keeps the audience engaged. When it's a shorter sort of format with a two-hour film or an hour-and-a-half film, whatever it happens to end up, you know, you have less time, and so it's not as oppressive that way. On the other hand, like I said, I think I've said this already, Larry and I tend to write very long scripts, and then we cut back. We narrow them down, and we tighten them up, and we eliminate things that are extraneous. But it's our sort of philosophy that it's, in fact, I said to Larry, I think I'm going to put this on your gravestone. It's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it, kind of thing. It's always more difficult to add to a script than it is to take away, because, you know, you have the elements that are already there in the storyline, and when you try to insert something in a script, very often everything in that story shifts, and it starts shifting at the very beginning, and so it has this sort of steamroller effect on it. So it's always, in our minds, better to have it start out a little too long and then shorten it.
You're unusual in that you're a writer and a producer.
Yes.
On many projects. So it would seem to be that dream situation where you almost have total control. That's what many writers would believe of your situation. Is that true?
Well, you never have total control, no matter what, even if you're the writer, producer, and director, because whoever buys your film or is going to give you money for it has some sort of input, whether it's a studio, an independent studio, whoever it happens to be. You know, they're going to give you some kind of input and feedback. But even so, you know, if you're making a film, for example, on the miniseries, yes, I'm the writer and a producer, and I can rewrite scenes right there on the set for the director or whatever we need to do. But the fact is, you've got a 200-plus crew, and all of these people are elements of this. You know, you've got your costuming, you've got your props, you've got the set design, and all of these people add elements to it. And you have to sort of guide them, but still some of their point of view has to enter into it because they're creating these other pieces. So no matter what, you never have total control. The only time you have total control is if you're, say, a fiction writer sitting in a little room with your typewriter or your computer, and it's just you and that paper. And even then, a lot of times, you kind of feel like you don't have total control because your characters kind of take over the story and run with it. So even as a writer, I think the concept of total control is just a fantasy. But certainly as a producer, too, you can kind of help keep it on the straight and narrow, the place that it really needs to be. But the other part of it is, too, you know what? I don't know everything, and I admit that right up front as soon as we start a film. I want to hear, I invite input and feedback from anybody, down to the craft services people. You know, if they have a notion or an idea, I'm interested to hear it. But it doesn't mean I'll always take it and use it. But hey, you know, great ideas come from odd places.
I have to say, some of my favorite moments in writing are when the characters will absolutely take it somewhere else.
Sure, yeah, it's kind of scary sometimes. Yeah, it's like, oh my God.
Yeah. It's the best feeling.
But it's fun. It's what keeps it interesting.
Working as a producer and a writer, but wearing those two hats kind of almost at the same time, is that difficult? How does that work? Because they're two very different disciplines, aren't they?
Well, they are very different, but, you know, for me, there doesn't seem to be really a conflict. Even if I weren't a producer, as a writer, for example, let's say they come back to us and they say, you know what, we need a scene rewritten because we have a different location that it won't fit. We can't film the scene the way it's written because the location doesn't work with the scene. Whether you're a writer or producer, you know, if I'm a producer and I'm there on the set, I can go and visually see the landscape. And I think that actually adds something. You know, the fact that I can actually see the location and I can write it to fit that location. You know, if we're off in our humble abode, when they give us this idea, they have to kind of describe the landscape to us and then we can write it. So in my mind, there's really not a conflict. I think if anything, it simply adds to the picture. The fact that being a writer, I'm also the producer. And it certainly, I mean, it adds more to my responsibilities. It's very hard. The physical act of making a film is extremely difficult. So in that way, it's a little harder.
But. Does it ever change what you write, knowing that you are actually going to have to go away and film this, and you're going to have to make it work on
you
on
know,
set?
It's actually helped being on set, because you learn enough on movie sets to know that there's a huge limitation on your budget and what you can construct and that kind of thing, and the amount of extras needed for a scene. So as you're writing, you may write it one way and then go back and read it and go, wait a minute, this is going to cost $3 million to film, just this whole sequence, so we need to fine-tune it back a little bit. But if you've been on a film and you've been able to get something like that filmed for a minimal amount of money and you know you can do it, then you can say, you know what, we did this thus and such on this film. I know we can do it for this on this film.
What difference has winning an Oscar made to you?
Well, I think it's made a difference in practical terms. I mean, you get, you know, we've certainly gotten more interest in us as writers, as screenwriters. It's also interesting, and I think I said this, that some of our old projects have come back to life. I find it interesting that they were just as good before we won the Oscar. They're really no different since we've won the Oscar, but, you know, people will pay more attention to them. Other than that, I mean, it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing for the film itself, and it's very gratifying to have won it. But, you know, I don't feel any different than I did before I won the Oscar. I mean, I feel like the same person. And, you know, I've been asked this question, which I think is interesting. Oh, you've done Brokeback Mountain. How are you going to top that? Well, I don't think about that. I mean, I'm moving forward, and I want whatever I do to be the best of whatever it happens to be. Whether it's that miniseries, which was the next thing I did after Brokeback, the miniseries of Comanche Moon, which is going to actually air on CBS later this year. I want it to be the best it can be. I mean, whatever project I'm working on, I want it to be the absolute best. I'm so proud of Brokeback, and it will always be there as a film. I'm very happy about that. But, you know, I've moved forward now to the next thing.
Did it take you by surprise how successful it became?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think hardly any writer writes with the notion or intention or awareness that they might win an award. That's not something you think about when you're writing. Mm. You just think about, you know, writing a convincing script with convincing characters and convincing storyline.
But it, I mean, in terms of the subject matter as well, if any kind of film came with the label that it would never be a huge smash hit success and get an Oscar on top
sure.
of it, you know,
it was this
you would have thought that.
Sure.
The gay cable movie is.
Well, I know, that's
it.
What people started calling it. We never called it that, mm-hmm. but sure, absolutely. But I knew when I read that short story years and years ago, you know, before we optioned it, I knew in my gut that this was a powerful story. And I wanted to get it out in the world in some major way. And I felt like, you know, that I wanted friends and family to read the story because it had moved me so much. I wanted other people to feel the feelings that I had felt when I read the story. And I just kept thinking right away, my brain was clicking, and I thought, okay, you know, reading. No. I think it would be more interesting as a film. I think we could do it as a film. We could get it to more people as a film. And that was my main goal. I wanted people to see a film that affected them the same way reading that story affected me. And I really think that that's what it did. And so I gotta say, whenever anybody comes up to me, a person at the grocery store, at a bar, in the checkout line, and says, you know, I saw that film and I loved it. That's what I wanted. That's why I made that film. I wanted it to touch people and to affect them. And even the people that didn't agree with it or maybe didn't see the film and talked about it, still, it started this kind of dialogue. And, you know, even when I go see a film that I might not like it, or I might not like the subject matter for whatever reason, if I go and see it and it moves me in some manner, whether it makes me angry or sad or happy, makes me laugh or makes me think, I feel like I've had a worthwhile experience, something that has stimulated me, moved me in some direction. So I'm always happy when someone says, you know, I saw the film, because I think that it's a moving film, and it definitely moves people the same way reading that short story moved me. I feel very lucky in that regard.
Which is all the more interesting when you consider, and you told this story earlier in the session, of people who kind of refuse to see the film because of the subject matter. Quite famous people as well.
Sure.
You wouldn't expect it all.
Right, exactly. And I was surprised by that, because I would see, even if I didn't necessarily agree with the point of view, because as a creative person, I would go see a film. In fact, I would be eager to see a film that other people found so controversial, because I'd want to know what I thought of it or how it affected me. I just want to know. I'd be too curious not to go. You know, I'm just too nosy. I don't know. But, you know, that's kind of, that kind of curiosity to me is a sign of intelligence. I mean, to want to know about and learn about worlds and lives different than your own.
So it's surprising when an intelligent filmmaker like Clint Eastwood, you hear, has not seen the
film.
Didn't see the
film. I was really kind of surprised.
Yeah.
It just made me kind of sad, too. Mm-hmm. I thought, gosh, if, you know, a smart filmmaker like that would not see this movie, I wonder how many other people won't see the movie for whatever reason. And then I was startled by that, but then I thought to myself, you know what, Diana, you can't think about that. All you can think is that it's their loss. If they won't see the film, it's their loss. It's an experience they won't have.
Now, talking about the future, what have you got coming up next?
Well, we've got the two TV pilots that we'll be working on, I'm sure, the rest of the year. We've developed a film with Tom Hanks and Playtone called Boone's Lick. Tom had read Larry's novel on a vacation one summer, and we didn't have agents or managers for about 7 years. The whole time we were trying to get Brokeback made. In fact, all the way through getting Brokeback made, we didn't have representatives except for an attorney. And Tom just called Larry's phone machine in Texas because his number's listed in the phone book and left him a message and said, you know, I'd really like to talk to you about writing this script if it's available. So we're doing that. We're working on that. And then we have another couple of feature projects that have been offered to us, one that we're seriously considering. I can't really divulge it until it becomes a done deal, until we commit to it. But we have lots of things coming our way. And I'm looking at some books and stories, too, that I'm thinking about whether we should adapt or not. I'd like to find something I felt very strongly about and passionate about, and that Larry would come on board, too, as well. And I'm also looking at things to do on my own now, too.
That will be quite a change for you, I imagine.
Yeah, you know, it's really fun to write with someone else. It's like you said, you get instant feedback. So, although if I write my own script, I can certainly give it to Larry and get notes from him right away. I know he'll tell me exactly what he thinks. There's a man who doesn't hold back.
Now, also, there's some that are already in the bag that are kind of probably being released this year.
Well, Comanche Moon, our miniseries that'll broadcast on CBS, that's later this year. They told us the broadcast date. I think it's in December, and that'll be airing. That'll be fun, actually. It stars Val Kilmer, Rachel Griffiths, the woman from 6 Feet Under, Steve Zahn, Carl Urban, Linda Cardellini from ER. She was also in Brokeback. Linda, I love her. She's adorable and so smart. That's coming up. That's kind of a big thing for us. We're excited.
And what's the premise of that?
That is the second in the Lonesome Dove series of novels. There are four novels in that group: Dead Man's Walk, Comanche Moon, Lonesome Dove, and Streets of Laredo. And that's when Gus and Carl are in their maturity as active rangers. It's about 15 years before Lonesome Dove.
Yeah, you showed a scene from it earlier today.
It's it's very funny.
Very funny scene.
Very funny.
So I'm personally looking forward to seeing
and
that very much.
And it's right after that scene that the thing just takes off and runs. So, yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that this December, hopefully. Thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Shooting Screenwriters. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to
Thank
you.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Anytime. I'm totally supportive of writers. I think we should all support one another. Even though we're competing for the same things, I think it's important to support each other. It's a tough, tough occupation.
Comanche Moon was broadcast on CBS this year and is now available on Region 1 DVD. Alas, we're still waiting for it to be broadcast here in the UK. A big thank you to Diana Rosano for talking to us and to David Pearson and everyone else at the Cheltenham Screenwriters Festival for making this interview possible. Hopefully, I'll see you all at this year's festival. Remember, if you're not a Shooting People member, you can join at shootingpeople.org. If you are a member, then you should know all about our Screenwriters Network Bulletin, which goes out to about 10,000 screenwriters around the world every weekday. Get subscribing and joining the debate. Thanks for listening. See you soon.